Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Writers Aloud. This episode introduces our interviewer, Carol Angier. Carol's the acclaimed biographer of Jean Rhys and Primo Levi. She was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2002 and is currently writing a book on W.G. Sebald. Here she speaks with the travel writer and novelist Miranda France.
Born in 1966, Miranda France read Spanish and Latin American studies at Edinburgh University. After working as a journalist for several years in Argentina, she was commissioned to write her first book, Bad Times in Buenos Aires, as a result of winning the Shiva Naipaul Memorial Prize. The Times noted her Chekhovian ability to make you laugh at tragic stories. Her second book, Don Quixote's Delusions, Travels in Castilian Spain, was praised by Jan Morris for, quote, a prose style and manner of thought that is unique to Miranda France. More recently, she has published a novel, That Summer at Hill Farm, published by Vintage, and is currently writing a second. Miranda has been a regular tutor for the Arvon Foundation and a long-standing book reviewer for British newspapers. She lives in London with her husband and two children. Miranda, you grew up on an English farm, dreaming of becoming a novelist. Then your first book was a non-fiction travel book about Argentina. How did that happen?
Well, it was partly a matter of luck, in that I'd spent these 2 years in Argentina working as a foreign correspondent. And when I came back to Britain, I saw an advertisement for a writing competition, which I went in for and won. And it was to write about a country that you find, or even a culture that you find alienating. And that's really how I had felt in Argentina. I felt very much out of step with the culture there. And so it was as a result of winning that competition that I was invited to write a book. I was commissioned to write a book. And really, if somebody hands you a check and says, go and write something, you have to give it your best shot.
I was going to ask you what attracted you to Argentina, but you just now told me that there was an alienation. Was there an attraction in the beginning?
Yes, absolutely. At university, I had read a lot of Argentinian fiction by people like Borges and Cortázar and another writer called Sabato, who's a bit like Camus, I suppose. And I loved that. I also was very seduced by the mythology around Evita and the Perons and the tango culture and this idea of a city that was rather like Paris, but very far away. All of that intrigued me. But to a certain extent, my boyfriend and I had just decided that we wanted to go and live in South America, and we thought there were too many correspondents in Mexico, and Argentina might be a better bet for us. So there was an element of chance, too.
Now, it comes out clearly from the book that you love Buenos Aires, but by the end of the book, you also hate it. Basically, your thesis is that Argentina should be one of the richest countries in the world, but it just doesn't work, and everyone who lives in Buenos Aires is driven mad by the chaos and frustration of daily life and by a deep sense of melancholy and loss. Can you tell us about this Argentinian tragedy, really, and especially what bronca means, which I found fascinating, and the need for psychoanalysis that all Buenos Aireans seem to feel?
Yes. Well, first of all, I should say that my book is very subjective. I've met all sorts of people who disagree with me and didn't feel that there was a problem with Argentine culture, although I have to say that Argentinians themselves tended to agree with me. I felt that it was a country partly that had been founded on a get-rich-quick mentality in the late 19th century. A lot of people went there hoping to make a lot of money and often did, but then they quite quickly left again. Whereas perhaps a comparison with North America would be that there was more of a sense of going to create a society that would be fairer than the one people were leaving behind in Britain. So that was part of it, but I also felt that more recently there was the tragedy of the dirty war in the 1970s when anything between about 10 or 30,000 people had been disappeared and murdered by the state. And that had never been, it has been now, but at the time I was there, it hadn't been acknowledged and properly apologised for. And I felt that, therefore, the society was somehow based on a lie, and that it's dangerous for any of us to try to live, to try to build our lives on a lie. And that was really what I felt affected people's day-to-day relationships. As for Bronca, well, that was almost a sort of a humorous observation about the way that people lost their tempers so easily, and that it seemed that small explosions could happen anywhere, in the middle of the street or in the middle of the supermarket. And the psychoanalysis was part of the way that people dealt with the Bronca. And it was also the legacy of the fact that a sort of intellectual class had emigrated there in the 1940s and brought a lot of that sort of Viennese psychoanalysis culture with them. And it was felt to be a sort of marker of your intellect and also of your ability to consider yourself and your own life. It was a mark of status to go to psychoanalysis.
Rather like New York, perhaps.
Yes, yes. But the extraordinary thing was that we knew people who really didn't have very much money who were going to analysis. So waitresses and artists were spending really quite a large part of their income, and some people were living at home in order to be able to afford psychoanalysis. So it seemed baffling to me in a way.
Well, you describe a lot of frustration in daily life, the queues, for example, and you tell a very amusing story, which I hope you're going to tell us is true, about using the telephone.
Yes.
In Buenos Aires. Tell us a bit about that.
We often had cross lines, so we'd pick up the phone and there might already be a conversation taking place on the line. And in some cases, the line often got crossed with the same person, so you got to know the person well enough that you could say, do you mind hanging up because I need to make a call, you know, or how much longer will you be, that sort of thing. I'm sure it's a lot more efficient now.
What about the queues? You told them that the queues were endless.
Yes. I don't know what the problem was with the difficulty in getting people out of supermarkets. Part of the problem was that you weren't allowed to take your own bag in, so you had to queue to leave a bag before you could go in. And then there was a lot of difficulty in having the right change because of fluctuations in the economy and hyperinflation and that sort of thing. But I also felt there was a mentality that it was good to make people wait somehow, that it was a symbol of your power over them. I mean, Argentina is by no means the only country where this happens. I'm sure it happens in a lot of, I might say, authoritarian countries or maybe just inefficient ones. But I do think that making people wait for your service is a way of humiliating them and impressing your importance on them. And I really disliked that.
Well, I think in the book itself, you managed to make it extraordinarily funny, you know, terrible queues and the way that people just leave their food and, you know, in the supermarket and leave, or they leave one another in the supermarket and leave, you know. The black humour that you infuse, as it were, perhaps that was more of a literary device even than something that you would actually cross your heart and say really happened.
Oh, no, I think Argentinians are very funny. They've got a great sense of humour and a good sense of black humour as well. And I mean, I remember my friend Raquel, who I mentioned in the book, telling me that one of her husbands had tried to arrange to have her disappeared. And she thought that was quite funny, although I'm sure at the time it wasn't. So no, in a way I was sort of riffing off their own humour. They're funny people. And when you live in a chaotic society, you have to laugh. I think that all books, well, at least the books that I write, have a kind of secret motivation as well as an explicit one. And the secret motivation, in a way, of Bad Times was sadness that I'd felt growing up. My brother died when I was quite young, and for entirely understandable reasons, the family didn't want to talk about it. And I think that idea of things not being talked about and of being under the surface is something that I keep coming back to in writing. And also, when something bad happens in a family, people sometimes perhaps want to pretend that it's all right and overcompensate with humour and happiness. And that was a behaviour trait that I learnt early on because I wanted the family to be happy. So I think for me, sad things, dark things, hidden things go hand in hand with a desire to be upbeat and happy. And I have to say that actually, I mean, somebody said that in writing about Buenos Aires, I'd found my perfect subject. It was true because they are also funny and sad. And the melancholy that you spoke about before is written into their founding literature. The tango is both sort of funny and tragic and poetic all at the same time. For me, it's an interesting combination of atmospheres. And I also like to feel that when I'm writing something, there's a kind of secret reason for writing it.
Now, it seems to me, you know, that you make a wonderful story out of it all, and you tell it with this terrific black humour, and also with great sympathy. I think you quote perhaps your friend Raquel or someone saying, well, you know, we feel at the end of the world here, we don't know where we belong. And Argentinians, as you describe them, are always looking back to Europe in a kind of nostalgic. You actually call it homesickness, although most of them have never been there. So that's a very interesting thing. Were you fascinated by that?
Yes, I was fascinated by it, and I found it fascinating that it was an opinion that you could find at every level of society. I mean, one of the people that I became really friendly with was the caretaker of Evita's grave in the Recoleta. And he knew so much about history. And then, because of being a journalist, I could request interviews with all kinds of people. And sometimes I met the foreign minister because we would talk about the Falklands for articles that I was writing. And so I really got to meet people from all kinds of backgrounds and echelons. And this idea of something having gone wrong in the country and of being isolated from Europe was very, very much reflected in a lot of different places and people. It may not be like that now, but at the time, that's the way it felt. And actually, there was a kind of disdain for other South American countries. People didn't want to think about travelling to Peru or Bolivia or Ecuador. You know, they always wanted to go to Miami or to Europe.
Now, we've talked about the black humour that you infuse into this story. Of course, though, Argentina isn't just funny in a dark kind of way. It's also deeply traumatized, as you said, by its history. The dirty war in particular and the disappearances in the 1970s mostly. And you explore that, particularly in one encounter with someone whom you call Carlos.
Mm-hmm.
And you like him at first. And then you discover that he was willingly and unrepentantly now involved and was probably one of the torturers. What was it like to come up that close to a perpetrator of evil, really? And how did you handle it?
I remember now what really struck me about him was that he had an enormous head and face and very tiny little hands. And he was moved by strange things. Talking about his English nannies brought him to tears. And then almost within 5 minutes, he said that he and a friend had watched a sort of pro-democracy demonstration. They were policing. And that he or his friend had said, isn't it a pity that all these people will have to die? And I didn't really understand what he meant. And it was only as he made several other similar observations, I began to realise. And then I was faced with, do I confront him with this in a forthright sort of way? But I thought that if I did, then he would just clam up. So I sort of danced around the issue and pretended to be, if not exactly on his side, then, you know, neutral, I suppose, in order to get a bit more out of him. But I remember being quite overcome at the time and having to go to the ladies and sort of compose myself and look at myself in the mirror and think, you know, you mustn't waste this opportunity to hear somebody's reasons, his defence for what he did. And in the end, he was quite willing to talk about, you know, his reasons for what he'd done.
Your second book, Don Quixote's Delusions, is subtitled Travels in Castilian Spain. So it's also a travel blog, but there are other times in the book. So there's a time you're looking back on, which was about 10 years before, when you were there for a year as a student. And then there are other times, too, including a later one, when you come back with your husband and your baby. Now, these other times are all about your own experiences of Spain. So Don Quixote's Delusions seemed to me much more of a memoir than a travel book, really. And I just wondered, would you agree with that? And were you feeling that when you were writing it? Was it a different book to write? And perhaps harder because of this personal element?
It was harder because by then I had a baby. I mean, the baby wasn't born until after I started writing it, but quite soon afterwards I had a baby, so it was much harder in that respect. For me, what it really felt like was a piece of detective work, because I wanted to look at this book, Don Quixote, which changed the whole course of European literature, and discover what it was that made the man who wrote it, Cervantes, come up with something so new and extraordinary. So I tackled it from that point of view. It was two-pronged, I suppose. It was about my experiences in Spain, and it was also about the importance of this book, Don Quixote. I wasn't drawing a connection between my experiences in Spain and the importance of the book, Don Quixote. I thought that they were two narratives that could almost sort of run alongside each other and dip into one another.
In Don Quixote's delusions, you've got the travel layer, if you like. You've got the memoir layer. And some of that's very personal. I mean, you tell about your first love, the Peruvian revolutionary, mm-hmm. who's a marvellous character. And then there's a layer of the literary meditation on Don Quixote, which you've just described, and about Cervantes himself. I wonder whether this complexity, you know, the different times and the different layers of memoir and travel and literary meditation, whether all that complexity made it harder to write.
Having said that, there wasn't particularly a connection between my life in Spain and Cervantes. In fact, there was really, because that character, the revolutionary, was quixotic in a way. And I call him a character, he's a person. And I suppose the theme of idealism and sometimes rather wrong-headed idealism was important in the book. My memories of writing it are really just of how incredibly difficult it was to find the time and the focus, really, having a baby.
So you've just mentioned quixotism, and it's, of course, a central subject of Don Quixote's delusions. I think it's also a central subject of Bad Times in Buenos Aires. You've said a little bit about what it is. Can you explain what quixotism is and why you're so interested in it that, if I'm right, you've written two books about it?
Yes, I never really thought about it that way. But I like people who are passionate and have ideas. And unfortunately, a lot of people who are passionate with ideas have got the wrong ideas, haven't they? Or too much passion. So I suppose that makes them interesting to write about. And I would probably class myself as being quixotic in some senses.
So what are you pig-headedly idealistic about?
I think I've got a great lust for life, actually. I've been told I come across as a quiet person, but I find life very extraordinary, and I sometimes feel that life is like a weekend party. You know, it won't go on for very long, and while it's happening, I want to revel in every aspect of it. I find people enormously fascinating and interesting, so I don't want to be too careful. Maybe in that respect I am quixotic. What I don't like about the quixotic personality is the refusal to admit that you're wrong. I dislike that. I wouldn't cling to an idea in the way that Quixote does. But I felt huge compassion for him as a character and huge compassion for Cervantes, even though an awful lot isn't known about him. So it was hard to get an entire picture of his personality. But the scene in which Quixote dies and actually renounces all of his quixotry is almost heartbreaking. And he says, I've been wrong and I've been out of my head and mad. And in a way, as he does that, he extinguishes his own character. So it's actually painful. I mean, it's an extraordinary scene. And to think that really nothing had been written like that before. Extraordinary, really. I mean, some of his writing, I feel, is comparable to Shakespeare, but that depth of understanding of a character.
I've heard you say that the start of a book is crucial. And I've heard you quote Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who says that the opening paragraph is crucial and it can set the whole theme and tone of a book. And I think that the opening of Don Quixote's delusions and the ending, too, are both wonderful. And your first line is, this book starts with a funeral and ends with a christening. And neither turned out to be quite what it seemed. And the theme of your book, I think, like the theme of Don Quixote, is the ambiguity mm-hmm. and uncertainty of the world, really, of reality. And your book ends with a scene of babies setting out in an uncertain world. Could you first of all just tell me about those two scenes, which are so wonderful, and how you decided to use them as the beginning and the end of your book?
Well, the first scene, I knew very early on that that was how I wanted to start the book. I had quite recently had my baby and didn't really want to leave the house, let alone the country, but I knew this memorial service was coming up for Cervantes, which is held every year. The whole idea of a memorial service held for somebody who died more than 400 years ago was so seductive to me that I felt I had to be there. So I went just for the night to Madrid. The scene is set up so that you think you're at a funeral, because there was a coffin in the aisle of the church and there were nuns hidden away praying loudly. And the feel was very much of a funeral, with the coffin especially, but the coffin was empty and it was in fact a memorial service for Cervantes. The scene at the end of the book, I think I fairly quickly knew I was going to end that way too, because I do like the beginning and the end to be set very early on with a book.
The book ends with a scene which takes place in a Castilian town. It's a ceremony that's held every year where babies are brought from miles and miles around and laid out on mattresses, which are in all the streets, all of the side roads up and down this little town. And then a figure comes called El Colacho, and he's representing the devil in flight from the Eucharist. And he goes around the town leaping over these babies. He wears absolutely the latest line in Nike trainers, I'm glad to say, because to see your own six-month-old baby lying there with this quite large person flying over the top of them is a slightly nerve-wracking experience. But anyway, he goes around leaping over the babies, and behind him comes a bishop and a lot of incense swirlers. People take it very seriously. It's supposed to protect your baby against hernias, but hopefully it works for a range of ailments. We've been very lucky with that child anyway, so it must work. So that's a kind of a christening, yes.
Pretty unusual, I would say. Let's go then to your third book. So your third book was, finally, a novel, as you had dreamed of writing when you were a teenager. And a novel with, at its centre, a girl growing up on a farm. So, to some extent at least, it must be a sort of autobiographical novel that we might expect someone to write first in their writing life. So, why did it take you to number three to get both to the novel and to your own family background?
Well, I'd had a two-book deal with my first non-fiction book, so that was fairly straightforward. But actually, it was one of the readers of my first book who said, I think this person could write a novel. And so that gave me a kind of justification, I suppose. It felt like permission to go and try. And it took that long to happen because by then I had sort of young children at school. I was pretty much tied to the house. I wasn't really going to go and do a travel book. So I thought, well, this is the opportunity really to stay at home and write a novel. And I just decided that it would be easier if I used certain elements that I knew very well. I knew the farm and I knew exactly where all the buildings were in relation to each other. So I used the exact topography of the farm I'd grown up on in the book. The girl in the book, yes, she's pretty much probably me at that age. But the story was entirely made up. So I had a lot of help in that the landscape, the buildings were all ones that I knew very well. Then I just had to make up the story. I confess the farmer is very similar to my father. I tried to move him away from my father, although in a way it was also a tribute to him, because the one thing that I loved about my father growing up was that he knew so much about nature and was able to teach me so much about plants and animals and that sort of thing. Perhaps it's only in retrospect that I realise how rich that was, how enriching, compared to how my life might have been if I'd grown up in a city and didn't know about any of these things. In some ways I wanted it to be a tribute to him.
And it's also, it seemed to me, an elegy for old-fashioned farming.
Yes, I set it in a year, 1976, when farming was changing. It was quite a crucial time in the introduction of new cattle breeds, for example, that were going to be able to get bigger and yield more in terms of meat and milk, and also the introduction of more chemistry in the plants themselves, the crops, bigger machinery. Yes, it was quite a pivotal moment. There was also concerns about whether or not to go into the common market as it was then. I think it's interesting to write about uncertainty, and in that sense it was a time of uncertainty.
You have a controversy or an ongoing battle between some of the forces of the new world that have come into this community and the people who live in it. So, you know, the character called Robin Payne.
Yes, in a way he's a sort of satire of what country people feel about townies. You know, he doesn't like the smells, and he doesn't want the baler to go past at a certain time or leave straw on the road and that sort of thing. And people in the country do feel very strongly about that kind of incomer, they call them, who wants everything to be beautiful and pretty and doesn't really want real farming or industry to take place. Yes, he's a caricature. And sometimes I wonder if it's really allowed to have caricatures working alongside serious characters. It's a difficult thing to get right. I'm having a bit of a struggle at the moment writing to get that tone, because I do like to use a tone that's partly humorous and partly quite serious. And sometimes getting the balance right is a difficult thing to do.
Hill Farm seems to me, despite its humour in the minor characters, a more serious in a way and more personal book than the other two, and a sadder book, which is strange because obviously Argentina is in a much worse situation, as you describe it, than rural England. And yet it did seem to me a sadder book, and I wonder whether that's something to do with England and your vision of it, or perhaps you're having a closer relation to the place you're describing.
If there's a feeling of melancholy to it, that's obviously partly nostalgia because I was brought up in those surroundings and I'm not there anymore. But I do think that I was interested in the isolation that people can feel in the country. Growing up there myself, I often felt very isolated and I was very much on my own, which turns out to be quite a good thing for a writer, maybe, but isn't so easy to bear when you actually are 11 or 12 or 13. So I think the isolation that's felt by the farmer's wife was something that is quite sad and was something that I was interested in.
As a last question, do you think that could have anything to do with your vision darkening with age? As you get older, are you seeing things differently?
No, I think I was quite dark when I was young as well. I just think life has the full range of colour in it, and I see all of that all the time. There's a temptation to think that things that are sad are somehow more serious and interesting to investigate, which I suppose would be almost a bit lazy. But to write a novel where everybody is well-adjusted and happy sounds somehow a bit boring, doesn't it?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Miranda.
That was Miranda France in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Miranda on the RLF website. And that concludes Episode 7, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in Episode 8, the non-fiction writer Max Adams considers the joys of long-distance walking, and the playwright and novelist Anne Coburn explores the importance of a writer's sense of place. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.